Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday, the 23rd of May. It is wonderful to have you aboard on the program this morning. We have we've missed you over the last 22 hours, right? Because we do 3 hours, so that would be 20, right? Is that something like that? We've missed you, and it's nice to have you back. Thank you for being here. We would love for you to be with us and write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. I will introduce our panel in just a moment and just remind you that we have all kinds of stories to talk about today. There's a lot going on in the news. The new things are just dropping at every moment, and so we will do our best to try to keep up with all of it. This morning we have a wonderful panel to help us out, as always, and we welcome them to the program this morning. Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel, is here. Good morning, Nick. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing great. Like to remind folks, views are my own, and I appreciate this panel this morning.
Very good. Yes, I'm glad that we give you a place where you can view your own opinion. That's good. Espouse. Yes, exactly. Thank you very much, Nick. Always good to have you. We welcome Heather Mulligan, CEO of the Business Council of New York State. Good morning, Heather. How are you?
I'm good. It's like Scotland out there. It's everything's so green and wet, but I'm great. I have my son Dylan is graduating from Marist tomorrow. So
congratulations. Beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah. Congratulations to him with a degree in philosophy, which
nice.
His father and his grandfather were both philosophy undergraduate degrees. And my dad actually taught philosophy. He was a PhD. So for all the people who like poo-poo the liberal arts degree.
What do you do with a philosophy degree?
Right.
Go to law school.
One thing you do is you teach philosophy at the college level, which is what my dad did. The other is you start a tech company, which my ex-husband did. So who knows? Dylan's very entrepreneurial. I'm sure he'll figure something out, but I'm really excited. I mean, this is the last one to come off the payroll. So,
I had a niece graduate 2 weeks ago, and I was just sitting there watching these kids graduate, and it's just it's really exciting.
It's
very, very exciting, and the world's at their fingertips, and it's a complicated world that they're entering, but boy, you spend some time with them and you feel pretty darn good that what they're going to be able to accomplish.
Yeah, amazing creativity, and Dylan's super entrepreneurial. I mean, even as a kid, people would show up at my house. He'd be like, "Oh no, that's for me. I'm selling him some shoes." You know, okay. I don't know how you know how to do this.
But I spent time with the kids, and I just thought to myself, "My God, I think you all should be much more bitter," but they're not, and that's good. That's good. That's they're entering wide eyed, and I think that's terrific. Congratulations
Thank
to
you.
Dylan and to and to you for all the great work that the parents and the support staff do in getting the kids through. Teresa Bourgeois joins us, public policy and communications expert. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. I'm doing all right. Thanks. Memorial Day weekend, I want to just note, honoring all of those who died in service to our country. So to those and to those who live with their memory, the Gold Star families, we're thinking about them this weekend. I know sometimes that gets lost in all of the picnics or whatever it is one has when it's as gloomy as it is going to be this weekend. But thank you to all those who served. I was looking just to remind myself of the history. It started as Decoration Day.
Yes.
But I didn't realize it was not until 1968 that it was renamed officially as Memorial Day, and then 71, I guess it became official. But happy Memorial Day to all those who served. And it's also National Lucky Penny Day. And as I said, I heard on the way in about how the Trump administration is getting rid of pennies, so I guess we're out of luck, but in any case,
I have so many of them, though. I feel like I'm sad.
You good?
Yeah.
I just like finding. I do like finding a little, you know, when I'm out. Whatever.
But you're a heads up person, right? If it has to be heads up, you don't pick it up if it's tails.
That's right.
Other than that, you know, if that's bad luck, and then
you don't
next
want bad
you know,
luck.
They take your pennies away.
See what happens.
Anyway,
yeah, that's right. See how this happens.
And cheers to all the graduates. That's so exciting.
Yeah. Really, it's going to be great. It's outside, so fingers crossed.
It's going to be nice tomorrow.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be. I have no idea, good. But yeah.
It's in Poughkeepsie, so, you know, it's in the south.
I will tell you,
we're going south.
This is a
warmer.
I'm going off here, but you know, we have beautiful, beautiful campuses across the region, and sometimes I believe that Marist is not mentioned among those as just being a spectacular, beautiful, incredible campus
and really an amazing experience for him. I mean, just good. Amazing,
a wonderful educational facility, and obviously we do a lot with Marist professors and students, and have had nothing but wonderful experiences. But boy, the campus itself is just a gorgeous, gorgeous place. I always love in the early spring drive by there. That's sort of the first sign of it's to me, it's an equivalent of a Robin, but you see because the athletic fields are right on the road, and you see the kids out playing baseball, and it's like, oh, okay, this feels good.
This is
good. This is fantastic. Yes, absolutely. All right, let's start in on what is making news today, and there are several things that are happening. And so where should we begin? I guess we'll start with Harvard University. So yesterday, the president announced that the administration was going to move to bar international students. They said it would block current and future international students from attending the university. The news this morning, which only took about 12 hours to brew, is that Harvard University is suing the administration. This less than half a day after the Department of Homeland Security said it would block international students from attending the nation's oldest university and one of its most prestigious. The administration action and Harvard's response signified a dramatic escalation of the battle between the administration and Harvard, and the university's forceful, almost immediate response served as evidence that stopping the flow of international students to Harvard, which draws some of the world's top scholars, would destabilize Harvard's very existence. In a letter to the Harvard community delivered Friday morning, Dr. Alan Gerber, Harvard's president, wrote, quote, "We condemn this unlawful and unwarranted action," adding that it, quote, "imperils the futures of thousands of students and scholars across Harvard and serves as a warning to countless others at colleges and universities throughout our country who have come to America to pursue their education and fulfill their dreams." The lawsuit, which accused the Trump administration of a campaign of retribution against the university, followed an announcement on Thursday that Harvard's student and exchange visitor program certification had been revoked, halting the university's ability to enroll international students. The university indicated that it would also be filing a request for a temporary restraining order, asking a judge to immediately block implementation of the administration action. So a lot there. There was a lot there last night, even more this morning. Teresa, I know you have been following the story very closely. What do you think?
So, yes, I'm I went to Harvard Kennedy School for my graduate program. And, I mean, I think Harvard, I suspect, touches our lives, every one of us, in ways that we might not even think about through the research that's gone on there, the discoveries that have come out of Harvard, the people who have come out of Harvard and gone on to, you know, create and grow companies or lead our country, or four of our Supreme Court justices actually went to Harvard, do they have to recuse themselves once this gets to the Supreme Court? I don't know, seriously. But in any case, I just find this so profoundly, profoundly disturbing, because one of the things that makes, for me, that made Harvard a special place was the students that I was in school with who were from all over the world. And that just enriched my education and informed my education, as I assumed it did to, you know, many other people and for generations at Harvard. And this seems like nothing more than bullying, intemperate bullying, but it comes with a very, very, very high cost, because having international students, whether it's at Harvard or a local community college or whatever, and our colleges and universities all over the country, I think is very, very important to a person's education. And for no real purpose, except for they seem to, you know, clearly they're targeting Harvard for show, to change the conversation, I don't know what. But I just think that this is dangerous and costly. And you see the economic impact, I think, at Union College here locally. Their class, this incoming class, is not the size it needs to be. And so that's creating an economic problem for them. And as you lose these non-U.S. students, you're losing tremendous talent. You're losing resources. We're not making connections that we can that can be used down the line. I think it's a really costly mistake.
I am struck by that. It does seem to be, okay, we'll do this, and then there's an action taken, and that's sort of watered down, and then we say, okay, well, now we're going to do this. And,
right.
And you just wonder how long this is going to go.
And
I mean, death by a thousand fairly deep cuts.
Yeah, and because they won't do what we told them to do. Now, what they told them to do was turn over the records, personal information, of all of their non-U.S. students and all of their activities, anything that they've been involved in. And, I mean, it's just, it is, it's just, a, it, to me, it's a dangerous request. It's a huge overreach. For what purpose? I listened to some legal folks and read some legal folks last night who said that the government doesn't have a case. You know, this will probably be dismissed. But even when Harvard wins, there's still a cost. And the cost is not only the financial cost, but it's the cost of these students who will be afraid to come to the United States. Right? How many students around the world are making the decision to no longer come to the United States because they or their families decide that it's just not safe? What's become of us when the United States of America is a place that's not safe for young people to come and learn? And how many of businesses, how many businesses in this country, in this region, in this country have been started by people who've come from other countries, done well, and then created new businesses in our country, right?
I mean, I think I have a couple different viewpoints on this. Number one, I always cringe at the use of governmental power on a selective basis, right? And so they're taking an authority that they have, which is the granting of student visas, which is a governmental function, and they're leveraging that against one institution, one only, saying, you know, you've failed to abide by these randomly applied rules and provide us with the sufficient information about the students who had to apply for the visa. So they had to provide that information to the government to begin with. To me, it's very much a red herring. This is not what it's about. This is about trying to damage Harvard because Harvard is, you know, symbolic of woke ideology. And they earned that to some degree, right? They had a lot of intolerance on campus for any dissent from very, very liberal viewpoints. Very much so. In fact, there's a professor who wrote a really great piece called Harvard Derangement Syndrome, which is in the New York Times, where he really walks through the entire analysis and he says, look, did we bring some of this on ourselves at Harvard? Yes, we did. However, this is the wrong, this is not the right solution. And it, to me, it's an abuse of governmental authority. It's like what, you know, the Chinese government did at the end of the Hundred Flowers Revolution, when they begged people to say, give us your opinion. And when the opinion that they got wasn't one they liked, they locked people up. Right. I mean, it's a use of governmental authority basically to impose a viewpoint or to stop free speech, which is really, really unacceptable. And I have a huge problem with it. But anyways, on the business side, yeah, you know, I mean, this is a country of immigrants. And very, very frequently you'll find that entrepreneurialism is very strong in the immigrant population. You know, it's very important that we be welcoming.
We're going to hold the conversation there. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue and talk more about this. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear what is on your mind as we talk about Harvard University and suing the Trump administration over the move to bar international students. Again, panel at WAMC.org. We will continue after this.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. We're back to remind you that the lockbox is open and you can support us now online or by calling on the telephone.
Sarah LaDuke, what an amazing morning so far. Now, you and I were blabbing for half an hour or so this morning
about
at 8:30
prior to
the panel. Here's where we are in the lockbox at this moment. $344,833.
It popped up again.
Exactly.
Beautiful. Thank you, everybody out there. We're so grateful that you, however, you know, inept we kind of feel as we, Ray calls it babbling. I call it broadcasting.
Right.
Just kidding.
Blabcasting.
¿Por qué no los dos? It's not mutually exclusive. It's both.
Oh, I like that.
Blabbing and broadcasting.
All right.
800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Let's keep it going. What did we say to convince you before? How can we say it again?
Well, we did talk about the fact that everybody who makes a pledge of any amount today gets one of our brand spanking new WAMC uninterrupted bumper stickers. It's a vinyl bumper sticker, which is removable, as opposed to some of those you put on when you were younger and you had to scrape them off. This one you would not have to do.
Right.
You know, if you were going to a fancy party or something and you didn't have any wanted bumper stickers.
Or you were, you know, you needed to trade in your wheels.
And you wanted to keep it.
Wanted to transfer it to your new ride.
That's a much better pitch. Anyway, any amount that you pledge will get you one of those. It's a beautiful new logo that we have come up with for this WAMC uninterrupted campaign. It's got a red on-air light, which may or may not be a depiction of the one in Studio A.
Depending on the day.
Exactly.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. We do have the uninterrupted bumper sticker. We also have a campfire mug, ceramic campfire mug. It's white with the uninterrupted artwork on it. There's also a tote bag, which is natural cotton, and a t-shirt, which is a black cotton t-shirt.
Nice. And there are different pledge amounts to get different combinations of that. But any pledge you make will get you the bumper sticker. Thanks to Daltrey in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Thanks to Frank in Elka Park, New York, getting the uninterrupted merch. And Frank says, with the way things are going in Washington, I'm not a rich person, but I need the news and the programming to undo the madness. Now and then I need something to keep me straight. That's from Frank in Elka Park. That was well said.
Very beautifully put. Thank you.
Thanks to Anonymous in Albany, New York, who is a sustainer. And so is Frank, for Pete's sake. Or for Frank's sake.
So is Pete, for Frank's sake, now, and wait, Frank, for Pete's sake.
Now, wait a minute.
1-800-323-9262. Thanks to Anonymous in Woodstock, New York, who says, on and on, keep going no matter what. We heard from Elizabeth in Troy, who is a sustainer and did get some of our uninterrupted merch. And thanks to Bill and Carmella in Schenectady, New York. Thank you.
One of the great things about the panel is when something big happens in the world, A, you can parse it a bit, but even if you know all the stuff, all the details that you'll find, it's sort of, in a way, it's like lancing a boil. You talk about things.
Great.
Is that good, Joe?
Joe popped up. He's like, I'm sorry.
That's our next bumper sticker. Lance the Boil, WAMC. What I mean is you get the emotions out and you put them on the table.
So that's the pus part?
Ew. Yeah. Don't look at me that way, Rangel.
I need to talk to Sarah Gilbert because I think I quit. No, not really. Not really.
Fine. 800-323-9262.
I do see what you were going for.
9262.
Sort of.
Skip the boil. All right? We won't do that anymore.
Skip it. Let it fester. 800-323-9262.
What I'm saying is you get the emotions out.
It must be a Friday. No, I got you.
When you lance that boil, it feels much better, right?
Yes.
That's the round table panel.
The treatment.
Is that better?
The treatment is the roundtable panel. The relief.
I'm getting some looks. All right, I'm not
you
looking
You deserve
over,
them.
I'm
you
not,
have earned them.
I'm not looking over to Studio A anymore.
1-800-323-9262. If you are currently able to keep your breakfast down and want to call and support WAMC, we're here. You can give us a call, 800-323-9262.
Lance that boil bumper stickers. No.
323-9262 or WAMC.
Was that wrong? Should we have workshopped that?
I just can't believe, like, I think Joe got whiplash popping up from you saying that.
We're going to do a new image campaign for the roundtable panel. Lance the boil.
Oh, gosh.
Listen to the
you
panel.
Know, Ray, if you get desperate, you feel free to bring out the, you know, the tumor or...
Yeah. Yeah.
Or goiter.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Oh, I like it. The okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what?
Those examples, I think they just scream, give us money.
We're going to bring that to the focus group for the next fund drive, Joe.
1-800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. Two against one. It's fine. 1-800-323-9262. I know when I've been beat. We all love this metaphor. It's all right. It's pleasant.
Listen, you were on a high wire here. Sometimes you fall off, right? 800-323-9262. Why?
I can't stop laughing.
Is it time to go?
It is nearly. Oh, it is. 800-323-9262 or WAMC.org. We'll try again next time. please enjoy the roundtable panel, which we've all worked very hard on, and thank you for supporting WAMC.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. And it's safe. You can come back. We're going to talk just about nothing gross, only politics, which maybe is gross. I don't know.
It's beautiful. It's a big, beautiful topic.
I think so. Absolutely. We've been talking with our wonderful panelists this morning about Harvard University suing the Trump administration just hours after the administration's move to bar international students and revoking their right to actually have those students come to the university. Heather, I had to cut you off there. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I just wanted to say, like, I think that this is an example of governmental overreach in the highest form. I think that anytime you single out an institution and give these sort of specious arguments as to why when it's as plain as day why they're going after Harvard, right? Because it's a symbol of the so-called woke left. And I think that it's just an abuse of governmental authority. I don't care if it's the right or the left who's doing it. I think it doesn't matter. It's wrong. And it's not how government should work. And I personally have said many times, I don't think we should ever have to be afraid of our own government. That is part of a democracy, is you shouldn't fear your government. And this is not a good tone or tenor. And Teresa mentioned that she was a graduate of the Kennedy School. Yeah. Well, I also, you know, have a certificate from Harvard I took an online financial accounting class, and there was no liberal politics injected in the course that I took. It was very rigorous, and I feel like it was a really good course and just an example of the multitude of contributions that these institutions make. Is very helpful to me professionally to understand, have a deeper understanding of financial accounting, and it was a very well-run class and just one small little piece of you know, all of the multitude of programs in addition to the R&D that contributes so much, right. And you know, obviously the on-campus education. I mean, 20,000, 25,000 students a year, I think. This is a big institution. its hands aren't completely clean in terms of, you know, being the shining example of tolerance and openness. But that's not the point. The point is your government shouldn't be able to take these kinds of actions on a one-off basis just to make a point.
We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Nick Rangel.
I mean, I just want to remark, having a liberal slant and being rigorous and a very good program is not mutually exclusive. Right. But, Harvard is responsible for so many notable accomplishments, and particularly in the area of research, where they've developed treatments for diabetes, for cancer, even, other advanced diseases. I think those type of programs are some of the first to kind of be on the chopping block when there are severe funding cuts. In the Capital Region, we are seeing kind of a chilling effect of the current administration's efforts in the space of immigration, and particularly targeting students on campuses. There's about 3,000 international students in the Capital Region. For Union College, as Teresa mentioned, it's over 10% of their student body. Mm-hmm. And that percentage increases in a lot of the advanced degree programs. So RPI in their master's and PhD programs, the percentage of international students is even higher. And so you do have to expect that if people are feeling that their investment in their education by coming to the United States is at risk, that they could be deported in the middle of their education after spending tens of thousands of dollars because the administration is just sort of changing its priorities, that they aren't going to come here. And it doesn't have to be because they went to a protest or not a protest, right? Like, it's not like most international students are going to protest. I think it's actually the opposite. But the fear that that investment is just wasted because of the whims, or because of kind of a contest of will between Harvard and this federal administration, that itself is the chilling effect, and that is going to prevent international students from coming to the United States to study here. And I think that's a huge detriment to our education system and also to the communities where many of those immigrants stay and become part of the fabric of the United States.
I agree. There is a huge risk in scaring off students, international students. A lot of higher education institutions, particularly the premiers, I think, will always have the ability to survive. They have so many applicants, but the foreign students that come in don't have the federal student loans. They don't necessarily require the same kinds of or get the same kinds of financial assistance packages. So a lot of the schools that are sort of maybe not Harvard, but next tier, and I don't even want to characterize it that way, but not as known. A lot of them are very dependent on international students financially because they fill a gap. And we do have a problem in the U.S. And globally, frankly, of a decline in demographics. So there's a lot more competition for students. The U.S. has always been known as the place, outside of maybe Oxford and some other universities in Europe, as the place to get the premier higher education. If that changes, that is a risk, to an economic risk to the country. Higher education is very frequently one of the largest employers in any community, public or private. And to the degree that we are undermining their ability to stay afloat, we are challenging local economies in many areas where they are the largest employer, higher ed and hospitals.
To that point, the Association of International Educators, this is from the Times Union, estimated that for the Capital Region, international students spent $188 million last year, including their educational costs. If we lost all of our international students in the Capital Region, that's a huge loss in the economic activity and the impact that economic activity has here.
Well, I think this attack, I just to echo your point, your points. I think that this attack on the universities in general is really an attack on our economy, because universities are, you know, three core things that do in this regard, which is they really are the drivers of research in this country, research and innovation. So much of the what's next, whether it's in technology or medicine, architecture, design, climate, any direction you can think of, much of that stems from the research that's done at universities. That's why moving away from research investments in universities is a real problem. All the basic research comes out of universities. But the second thing that they do is they prepare the workforce. They prepare who's next, you know, who's going to go into, and Trump says he wants to strengthen manufacturing in this country. You don't do that without universities preparing the workforces. That's why every CEO in the country should be up in arms about this attack on universities. And the third thing is, as you both say, they are often like hospitals. They are the economic drivers in the community in which they sit. Think about MIT, Kendall Square, or, you know, what's happening here with RPI. You see the difference in Troy, and if this CHIPS moves forward, if we don't lose our position as leaders in CHIPS, it's going to be a game changer for this region. And so I think that the attacking these universities is not only is it wrong, but it's a real economic mistake. I will say one thing that happened late last night, which is a judge, a California judge, they temporarily paused the Trump administration's revoking student visas. It was not the Harvard case. It was a different case that's been pending.
Yes.
But that was, I think, a very, very important decision. And now, I guess, in the world of Trump, we have to say who appointed these judges. And this judge, Judge Jeffrey White, was a George W. Bush appointed judge. But they granted a temporary injunction protecting international students who were among the thousands whose visas were revoked earlier this year. So that is a good sign. But regardless of this, this is just a temporary fix. And it sends a chilling message that you're not wanted here.
The listener letters are piling up. I want to get to those. We'll take a quick break and we'll start going through the list right up. All right, time to go to letters and find out what's on people's minds in regards to the story of Harvard suing the Trump administration after the move to block international students from attending the university, to bar international students from Harvard University. We go to Matt. One of the things I noticed right away in the Trump administration's One of the things I noticed right away in the Trump administration admonition of Harvard is the secondary reasoning found in the announcement, namely that Harvard is coordinating with the Chinese Communist Party. It seems as if the Trump administration has so little confidence in their shenanigans that they find it necessary to gaslight their own gaslighting. Like they are saying, if you think the first thing we said was insane, then listen to this. It's very fortunate that proxy President Stephen Miller is incompetent, inept, and almost always on the wrong side of constitutional law. Therefore, we can use the Trump playbook against him and keep suing everyone.
It is important to keep an eye on specifically what the administration is demanding to know about those international students, and particularly what kind of access they want to their personal, not just their personal information, which is all supplied through their application for their visas and their applications to the school, but what they want to know about the students' whereabouts and activities, day-to-day activities on campus, which, unless they've been found guilty of a crime, are legal activities or not convictions. They want to know if they've ever been stopped or arrested. They want to know what their disciplinary records are. They want their coursework. And Teresa mentioned they even want their actual cell phones. And the question has to be, if they win this standoff, why won't they then access all of those same things of every other student on campus? And what is the plan for that material? How will that be used against young people? And I just note that young people are supposed to be able to explore different ideologies, different opinions, different political communities, right? They're supposed to be able to exercise their speech, exercise their curiosity, and do that in a somewhat safe space and not necessarily have every tweet ever tweeted held against them for the rest of their life. And we live in like a different universe now, but there have been plenty of students who participated in certain kinds of political speech that maybe later didn't still agree with the political speech that they had shared in the moment. And we're just sort of dismantling that like protective layer for campuses. And I think it will impact the way students develop into the kind of adults that they're going to be.
It's beyond chilling.
Let's go back to letters. We go to Ben. It's so disappointing and exhausting to hear the panelists say that Harvard somewhat brought this on themselves because it was too woke. This narrative is absolute bunk.
Who said that?
It's
That's not what I said.
We'll get to that in a second. It's like those that say Ukraine somewhat brought Russia's invasion on itself by trying to join NATO. No, it is not what you said, if you would like to clarify. Please.
No, I mean, I said that Harvard does not have entirely clean hands. They can't say, we don't know what you're talking
We've
about.
We've never done anything.
Right, yet. Right. I mean, there's a documented history of, you know, some issues where professors were disciplined for not saying things that were politically correct. I mean, all of those things are, that doesn't matter. My point was that doesn't matter. Harvard is being used as an example, and it is being used as an example because the oldest, most prestigious university, sorry, everyone else.
sorry, you know, rest
but,
of the world.
But, you know, it is the iconic, you know, symbol of American higher education at its apex, and it has this huge endowment. And, you know, so there's a lot of reasons why it is a target. All of that being said, it doesn't justify it. I mean, I'm not an all black or all white person. I don't believe that anyone is all good or all bad. I think that Harvard made mistakes. I don't think they deserve this.
Yeah, and I absolutely do not believe that Harvard brought this on themselves. And I think that there are, I think there might be more diversity of thought than the character says that there is. I know that was my experience, was quite a bit of diversity of views. And even in the Kennedy School where I was, it was quite a bit of diversity of views and political background, which is why it was such a rich experience for me. But I do think that in the United States of America, that should be allowed. I mean, there are universities in this country who are deeply conservative universities where people of a more, you know, different views would not be as welcome. But you know what? They get to do that, right? That's the United States of America. So anyway, letters, sorry.
But right. I just, you know, we keep talking about, we're like defending or not defending Harvard, but it is the students who are under attack. It is the students' information and privacy that's being bargained over, right? Because students choose what school they go to. These students chose to go to Harvard. Whether Harvard is liberal-leaning or not liberal-leaning is irrelevant. People made a choice with their money. They made a choice to spend their money at that school, and now they individually are losing their own personal privacy because an administration doesn't approve of where they spent their money.
And those international students especially.
Those international students especially.
Yes.
But every student makes a choice with their money,
right,
on what kind of education they want. I left a school because I thought it was too conservative. And I decided to bring my money to a different school that aligned more closely with what kind of education I wanted to pay for. Students are investing in an education. These students are investing in their education at Harvard. Those degrees that say Harvard mean a different thing
right.
than a degree from a different school. And that is an investment, and that is what's at risk here.
I do think this particular case that came up yesterday was just about the students, but I guess I'm thinking it more broadly, that this is a piece of a larger attack by the Trump administration on the university, attack on their research, attack on their endowment and stuff.
I'm talking about Harvard very specifically. I mean,
yes,
they cut off their federal funding. And then, I mean, and the quote from Noam, because I just pulled it up, Christy Noam.
It is shocking.
It is a privilege to have foreign students attend Harvard University, not a guarantee. The United States government understands that Harvard University relies heavily on foreign student funding from over 10,000 foreign students to build and maintain their substantial endowment. This is about Harvard. This is about Harvard being the target, individual university being the target of an assault, a multi-front assault by the federal government.
Much like Columbia.
This is a direct attack on
Harvard.
If you read this statement, yes, the students are the ones. They're essentially collateral damage in this, right? This is the federal government using its power to go after one institution for things. Again, it's selective prosecution.
But it's a multi-pronged attack. They're going after their nonprofit status. They're going after how they treat the tax on their endowment.
Yeah.
And that most of all, that we should all be worried about, because we all benefit from, they have reduced, I can't remember what the number is now because it was a third round of cuts recently, of pulling back existing grants. And these, in some cases, these are grants for clinical cancer trials, where people are in the midst of these cancer trials and they're pulling back. And I know we're going to get to the MAGA event yesterday, the health event. But as I sat and listened to them at this health event, I thought, look at what you're doing to health research at universities, including Harvard, the research that you're interrupting, and then the research that won't happen because you're pulling back future grants.
Research being conducted by students.
We have to take a break, but I'm just going to leave this question in the air here, and we can address when we come back. But you think back to December 8th, 2023, when Elise Stefanik was grilling those college presidents. What set that up? Because that seemed to be the building block to all of this, of what led to
because she was on an advisory panel at Harvard Kennedy School, and she was taken off the advisory panel.
Right. So we'll
I don't talk, know what's in her heart, but I do know that that happened.
We'll talk more about that after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Joining us on the program, public policy and communications expert Teresa Bourgeois, CEO of the Business Council of New York State, Heather Mulligan, and Executive Director of the Legal Aid Society of Northeastern New York, Nick Rangel. Thank you all for being here. So we're going to change the subject and move on and try to get to a couple of other things before our time ends in about a half hour or so. We go to this story, which is breaking this morning. President Trump threatened to revive his global trade wars this morning, saying he would apply a steep tariff to European exports starting in just over a week, and warning Apple that iPhones manufactured outside the United States would face a 25% tariff. The president wrote on Truth Social this morning that discussions with the EU are going nowhere and that he is recommending a 50% tariff on European imports as of June 1st. The European Union, which was formed for the primary purpose of taking advantage of the United States on trade, has been very difficult to deal with, Mr. Trump wrote. Trade is in all caps, shiny caps. He claimed the bloc's trade barriers, taxes, corporate penalties, and other policies had contributed to a trade imbalance with the United States that was totally unacceptable. In an earlier social media post, the president also targeted Tim Cook, the executive chief executive of Apple, who visited Mr. Trump at the White House last week. The president wrote that iPhones sold in the U.S. should be manufactured and built in the United States, not India or someplace else. If they are not, Mr. Trump said, the smartphones would face a 25% tariff. Are any made in the United States as of now?
No.
Okay. So that
according to reports that I read during the night.
So it seemed like it would be difficult to do that with between now and June 1st.
No, yeah, you'd have to create an entire different manufacturing system here in the U.S. But also, like, the cost of manufacturing and building iPhones in the U.S. would be a lot more than just a 25% increase on those cell phones. So,
and do we have the raw materials?
Let's go back a little bit.
Let me read one more line, and then we'll get into it. The Post.
This is high level crazy.
I interrupted myself,
and I'm not interrupting you.
Let's go. The Post appeared to rattle financial markets with stock futures pointed sharply lower in pre-market trading in Europe. Carmaker shares were the worst hit. Shares in Mercedes-Benz fell about 4.5%. Shares in Volkswagen and Porsche were down more than 3%. So there we are. And to me, the key line again is to escalate his trade war and to revive the global trade wars, which I think generally it is taken, and I don't. If you are not on this side, then I understand, but that most people didn't think was overly successful. Hence the 90-day reprieves that were given on several occasions.
I'm just going to say a couple things. First off, the idea that we would have fully completed manufacturing in the U.S. of something like an iPhone, where the glass is made in New York. The chips are made in somewhere. The phones are really only assembled in China, I believe. That's my last I knew. The phones were assembled in China, but component parts came from all over the world.
All over the world.
There's a reason for that. Some of it is the cost. The assembly cost in the U.S. is significantly higher than in China. And it would offset, like, because of the shipping and all of that, it would still, you'd make out better by sending all the component parts to China, putting it together there, and sending it back here. And with vehicles, we've got vehicle manufacturing in the U.S. Some are not American brands, right? You've got foreign automakers that are actually assembling cars here. Some American auto manufacturers assembling cars in Mexico, parts going back and forth across the Canadian border. It doesn't recognize the reality that manufacturing, this is not just making a widget in a factory and there, boom, it's done. It's much more complicated than that. And the idea of tariffs applying to the product every time it crosses the border upon import or export, I mean, it's kind of an absurd notion. With vehicles, I mean, initially they were saying every time it crosses the border. So the tariff, if it's 20%, it's 20% going one way, 20%, every time it comes back. And that, it doesn't work. That being said, U.S.-based manufacturing, we learned the hard way during the pandemic that we ceded too much of it. There are certain things that we need to have the ability to make here ourselves, and we allowed non-competitive practices by other governments to drag things like paper, manufacturing, health paper-related products like masks and gowns and all of that. There was virtually none of it left in the U.S., even though we have a very strong paper industry. And I always pick on this one because New York has a strong paper industry, but they can't compete against countries that have no environmental regulations, that don't have forest management rules, that don't have all the rules that apply here, right? That's an area where it would make sense to have some tariffs on the import of products, but it should be by product and specific to the activities of the country from which that product is coming, not these, multi-input, complicated, high-tech devices that pieces of it are manufactured all over the place.
I'm going to ask this question for two reasons, and one is because I'm extremely curious, and two, it's because I want to say the word willy-nilly. But the 25%, the 50%, that doesn't come from anywhere, does it, other than being willy-nilly, in the sense of we went up to 150% tariffs and then we're back down to 30%.
There's a wheel. You push a button. And what is today's, you know?
Well, that's what it feels like.
But I really do think it raises a different, a related question, which is I think you need to step back and say, what is going on that drove him to post about this morning? Right? Because is it a distraction? Is it because he needed to distract from what he was doing last night with his a private meeting with international people with his meme coin or whatever it is, which is a major grift as far as I'm concerned? Or is it because he needs to create some sort of distraction from the substance of what's in the reconciliation bill to see if they can keep moving it through? Or did somebody talk to him last night and put a bug in his ear? And so that he, I mean, the President of the United States should not be running trade policy on his social media platform, right? He's driving trade policy on his social media platform. And so that the 25% does seem arbitrary. The timing does seem arbitrary. Was this planned? Did his trade reps even know he was going to do it? And what is the cost? What's the economic cost when the overnight markets dropped precipitously? They seem to be down still, 300 and whatever points, but how much are we going to lose in the markets this week because of this, right? Or what's the impact with our potential trading partners? What business are we going to lose because there's so much instability? Because businesses, I hear it over and over, they need stability. They need predictability, right?
Yeah, I mean, a couple things. I don't think it matters. I mean, I'm assuming if you take it at face value that the talks with the EU are faltering, and that this is a point of leverage, a statement being made to try and get them to you know, sit up and fly right or
that
whatever.
That presumes it's strategic.
Right,
but
right.
Is it?
But does it matter? Does it matter?
It does.
I don't think so. I really don't. I think the
because
ultimate...
Because it's costly.
Well, yes, it's costly. But the reason why, to me, doesn't matter. It's that this is the approach that matters. Whether it's strategic or not strategic, it's damaging, and we're losing credibility. We need certainty. We need a playbook that is going to be stuck to, that you can look at and say, okay, we're going to have trade deals with all of these countries, and until there's a trade deal, the tariffs are X. Fine. I don't agree with tariffs. I don't think that blanket tariffs, and I said that earlier, I don't think that they make sense. I think that they do make sense in certain instances, and they make sense where you have behavior by other countries where we are being very much taken advantage of. And those things are true. I mean, there's virtually no industry in the U.S. because of the activities of the Chinese government, which subsidized companies to come in, buy American factories, learn the designs, and manufacture them in China, and now those industries are gone. All of that as way of background, but I just want to say, I don't think why he's taking this approach, the underlying I don't care. I think it's just wrong. I think what we need to do is have someone steady the ship. And
but who's going to do that?
Well,
Bessin has been trying, but clearly
it doesn't
work.
You would think that the market reaction would be something that would, like, someone would go, oh, wow, look at this. You know, this is really a problem. The markets are so unstable, and we're undermining our ability even to control, you know, inflation and get back to a safe interest rate environment, because the uncertainty is making it impossible for the Fed to act even. So all of these things are contrary to what the stated goal is of the administration, which is a strong American economy. You can't have that with all of this uncertainty. You need predictability.
Nick Rangel.
And I mean, it is true that there have been some instances where foreign policy has diminished the ability of specific American companies to compete at a level playing field. And that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
What's interesting about these particular tariffs, though, is it's broadly across pretty much everything that comes out of the EU. And a lot of that is pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. And what's not getting as much attention is the impact on the cost of healthcare being hit by tariffs that historically never existed at all, let alone at these increasingly high rates. And some pharmaceuticals are comprised of over 100 components. And so it's a tariff on each of those components. And it's a tariff on medicines that are life-saving and crucial for somebody to maintain any quality of life. And you're talking about a person's ability to just be alive. Like, there's a massive difference between my ability to go buy my favorite car in the favorite color that I have versus being able to buy the medications that keep me alive. And that needs to be a conversation that's taking more of the focus or more of center stage on this particular piece. And I think what we're saying and we're agreeing is that it may be that tariffs are an effective tool to encourage production of certain types of goods in the United States. Not all goods are going to be able to be made in the United States, and those are going to just have higher costs. But pharmaceuticals have to be treated differently. They can't be treated like my cell phone.
And you're getting to my point that you need to be more strategic about what and why there are tariffs. Because if you really want to drive behavior and level the playing field, it's not 20% on everything. And I'll give you an example of where U.S. policy drove manufacturing out of the U.S. When the Affordable Care Act first was being negotiated, one of the pieces of it was a tax, an export tax on medical devices manufactured in the U.S. And as a result, companies that were U.S.-based, and there are several examples in New York State where they moved their medical device manufacturing outside of the U.S. so they wouldn't be subject to the tax because it was an export tax. So that's just an example. I mean, you have these perverse results from policies that, if they're not well thought out, you end up with a situation where you have less of what you want more of.
But that is why you don't, as Joe says, do it willy-nilly.
Right.
Right.
Let's say we
do want to bring pharmaceutical development and production back to the United States. And I'm reading from an article, reshoring a new facility into the United States can take 5 to 10 years because it's a pharmaceutical. It requires lots of oversight, permits, development, and costs $2 billion per facility. Right. Like, in the meantime, people are going to lose access to the medications and pharmaceuticals that they need while we try to reshore. Like, that's not an effective or productive way to partner with that industry.
But pharmaceuticals is interesting because I was really disturbed yesterday listening to when they had the RFK did his presentation of his health, whatever he called it, his MAGA. Sorry, it was laughable. But in any case, the president got a little distracted in his remarks, talking about his election, but also then talking about his drug cost containment approach, which is rather unusual if you saw his recent executive order, where what he's basically saying is that he doesn't want to, he's not blaming pharmaceuticals, he's blaming other countries for entering into these agreements of cost, and that they get costs that are a lot lower. So he wants to equalize the cost. He wants the U.S. costs to go down, but other countries' costs, they have to pay more so that the pharmaceutical companies will get the same amount of money. I mean, that's just bizarre. There is a system that was in place to contain drug costs in this country. The Biden administration worked that system in the last administration, and they did get 10, 15, 20 drugs, I can't remember the exact number, contain those costs for Medicare and Medicaid purchases. And then the the Trump administration should keep at that and continue negotiating prices down. But instead, they've moved into this other bizarre approach to raise prices on other countries so that we lower prices in the United
States.
Well,
philosophically, I do understand the argument. I'm not saying it's correct, but you know, a vast majority of the R&D expenses are built into the pricing in the U.S. That is definitely not always the case in European markets. And also the way that we apply the rules that I guess I don't know if it's patents or patents, I guess the rules around that. There's only a limited time frame in which the companies are able to recover the costs of the R&D. And a lot of times that is the market. The first market is the U.S. market. So you're going to have a built in upfront higher cost always. I think the argument they're trying to make is that if the drug goes on the market everywhere at the same time, the R&D cost should be spread across the globe, not concentrated in the U.S. That's my
But he's saying limited. These countries are ripping us off.
Right.
These countries
they're saying because negotiated they're not paying, the price. They're not paying for the R&D
But the problem
cost.
Is that the U.S. didn't negotiate a good deal.
Right. Well,
because they've been blocked from doing so. So you want to say a developing country has to pay a lot more for drugs because
I'm
the
not,
U.S.
I'm not saying that. No. All I'm saying is
I think the argument
is that the R&D cost should be spread out equally across the globe and not concentrated in the U.S. market. But there are so many other factors involved, including where is this version being manufactured?
And where are the component parts from and so on and so forth.
Right.
I mean, it's just...
Time to take a break.
Yeah.
So we will do that, and we'll come back, and we'll wrap this puppy up for Friday, and we would love to hear from you, panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Very nice to have you with us on this Friday morning. And we just have about 10 minutes or so, and I want to finish up all of the try to get to a story or two before we knock it off for this week. I will say that we are off on Monday. We are taking the Memorial Day holiday. We will be back to discuss all of the things that happened over the weekend. I'm sure it'll be a very quiet, non-turbulent news weekend.
What could happen? It's already happened. Everything has happened already.
Everything that's going to happen. I only wish that were true.
Here we go. So we'll be back on Tuesday, and I know if you miss us on Monday, that just will make it more sweet on Monday or on Tuesday when we come back. All right, let's take a look at we've been talking, I think, all week and even all last week about the budget bill that was the domestic policy bill that was passed by the Congress. And now House Republicans are taking their turn. Senate Republicans will take their turn, and the Senate will look and to see what is on the table here. They look at this, obviously, within hours after passage, Senate Republicans made clear that the debate within their party over the measure was far from over and that there would be significant changes in any measure they managed to send back to the House. Some of those could easily alienate House Republicans who already swallowed considerable reservations about the bill to vote yes. All right, Teresa, you're our budget watcher.
Yeah, well, I think that it's a different calculation on the Senate side, so I'm not surprised that the House was able to pass it. I guess I'm not surprised. But it will be interesting to see because on the Senate side, there are different calculations. And there are a group of senators, very conservative senators, who think that the cuts didn't go far enough and that want to make sure that the tax breaks are paid for, which they are not even close to being paid for. I think it's, trillions of dollars, not close to being paid for. So it will be interesting what happens there. There's also a group of senators, Republican senators on the Senate side, who are concerned about the loss of some of the clean energy provisions, because, interestingly enough, a number of Republican states did move forward on some of the climate change, some of the solar and clean energy provisions that the Biden administration had put in place, and they're finding them to be useful. I'm talking about you, Texas, and some others. So the revoking of the tax incentives for clean energy is a problem for a number of them. And I also think that the other thing that happens in the House bill is that really they have it's a reconciliation bill, but really they're sending the bill back to the states in many cases. Education costs back to the states, FEMA costs back to the states, food security back to the states. And so just as an aside, it'd be interesting to see Elise Stefanik, they say she wants to be governor, and Lawler, Congressman Lawler in New York State, wants to be governor, yet they supported this bill. So if they're governor, are they going to appreciate these costs? And then I think there's a number of things that'll be discovered in this bill. The $160 billion, $160 billion to detain and deport people, $46.5 billion for border barriers, $45 billion for adult and family detention. This is really a boon or a boondoggle for the private prison industry, and so I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on that. So I think it will be it codifies a number of things that people are concerned about. We've already talked about university-based research, that those deep cuts are codified there, as well as the deep cuts to the Weather Service, deep cuts in agriculture. Interestingly enough, for the SNAP program, the target cut was $230 billion, and they cut $300 billion because they've added in $60 to $70 billion that they're going to need to bail out the agriculture industry because of their such deep cuts in the food security programs. So they're cutting more deeply into the food security program so they can find the $60 billion that they're going to need to subsidize the farmers for the deep cuts they're making in the food security program. So we'll see what adds up. We'll see if in the end they do all just because they want the tax breaks for that are going, as we know, to the wealthiest, the majority of them. We'll see if the Republicans do get in line on the Senate side as they did on the House side. But right now, I don't know how they thread that needle given the number of folks. And if they don't pass the identical bill, how are they going to reconcile the two bills? Because where they're just opposite points, you know, the agreements are in such opposite directions, the disagreements.
Heather?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's a lot going on here. I think the risk with the Senate is their majority is so slim, and New York is not at the table, right? And so one of the most important things that's in this bill, in my opinion, is the raising of the cap on state and local deductibility, which Lawler and Maliotakis and the Republican House members fought very, very hard for and got some significant movement on. I mean, for folks who are not familiar, prior to the last tax bill, which is the extension of, state and local taxes were fully deductible off of your federal income taxes. For the first time, a cap was placed on that of $10,000. And in New York, which is a high property tax, high income tax, high business tax state, that is a significant tax hike on New Yorkers because we no longer can fully deduct the state and local taxes. There are a lot of trade-offs for it, including elimination of the alternative minimum tax, which prevented a lot of people being able to access deductibility of state and local taxes to begin with. But ultimately, it was not a good thing for anyone who has a business who files a certain way in New York, or for people who live in areas that have relatively high real property taxes. I mean, Capital Region, if you have anything on the waterfront in the Finger Lakes, people pay massive amounts of real property taxes, and there's no longer an offset for that against your personal income. This bill does fix some of that. It raises the cap significantly, quadruples it, but it also places some income restrictions on it. I think $500,000 to be fully, once fully phased in, to access the full $40,000 in deductibility. All of that being said, nobody in the Senate cares about SALT, right? Because there are no senators who are Republican from California or New York or New York or New Jersey or any of the blue states. So there's no one to protect this provision. If the provision comes out, that now you have a problem with the House, right? Because they have a very slim majority and you need the Republicans from the blue states to actually approve however the bill is modified. Unless you get some Democrats to cross over, which I think is highly unlikely. No. So we're in a, it's definitely a bit of a boondoggle. I mean, the most elegant solution in my mind would be for the Senate Republicans and Democrats to sit down together and try and figure something out here that where they can actually pass a bill that is modified that satisfies the needs of every state, whether it's blue or red. But I think that will happen like on never day. I will buy a scratch off lottery ticket and win on the same day that that happens. I think it's we're in an interesting point. If the bill does not pass, if we do not have a renewal of the tax bill, the big, beautiful bill, which is, you know, it's renewal of some of the historic tax cuts that were made that, yes, everyone complained that all of the tax cuts went to the wealthy. That's not actually true. A lot of New Yorkers benefited greatly from the elimination of the alternative minimum tax, despite the cap on state and local. But on small business, there's actually a calculator on the U.S. Chamber webpage. You can go, you can put based on your own current tax filing information, and this is for businesses, you can see what your tax increase will be if this bill does not pass. So right. there's a lot of high stakes here.
All right. We only have a minute left, and I want to get Nick in. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think, first off, staunch right-wing Senate Republicans have already said they're voting against this bill and seem pretty adamant about it. It does raise the deficit. Even though it also makes significant cuts into social safety nets, I think the bill exasperates and will plunge more people more deeply into poverty with fewer avenues of achieving economic mobility, including not just SNAP and Medicaid cuts and really just kicking people out of programs that they really rely on and have relied on, but also reducing access and kind of gutting the student loan programs and subsidized loan programs and a number of other tools that have been very, very successful in getting people out of the cycles of poverty and into higher economic success. And that's, I think, really damaging.
We're going to end it there. My thanks to everyone for being with us, for everyone who wrote in. And if you got your letter read or didn't, we thank you very much for participating. Teresa Bourgeois, Heather Mulligan, Nick Rangel, you're all wonderful. Thank you so much. Have a beautiful weekend. We'll be back right after this.